Directors are simple, uncomplicated people with straightforward needs. Actors are generous to a fault and never allow their various anxieties to inflect their relations with other people. Playwrights are easy as pie. And we're super nice. All the time. Choreographers never pick favorites or whipping posts. Designers never change their minds 1,000 times. Technicians are up for anything. And they never need to be coaxed to do a thing 1/8 of an inch to the right of their job description. Fight directors are fun guys with totally realistic ideas about what will look cool on stage. Audiences are docile, on time, never piss or die in their seats, make noises only when appropriate, and are incapable of complaint. All of these people are beyond reproach, and so the stage manager's job is a simple one. They are charged with turning vague ideas into stage magic on time and perfectly, night after night, for hundreds or thousands of patrons. Hi, I'm Michael Healy, and this is Just One More. Stage managers show up before you do, leave after you leave, and are in charge. Though you'd never know it, they are the keepers of the text, of 1 billion union rules, of the very event itself. First, a story from Tanya Grieve about working at the Blythe Festival in Southern Ontario. If you've never been to the Blythe Festival, it's a beautiful theater in a beautiful spot. The play was called He Won't Come In From the Barn. It was set in a barn, and as you'll hear, the design got out of hand.
I can tell you about my very, very first equity contract. It was on a show called He Won't Come In From the Barn, written by Ted Johns. And on that first contract, part of my job was to look after the livestock that were part of the show. So Ted lived on stage for the entirety of the show because he didn't come in from the barn. The unique thing about the production that I worked on was I also did the remount with an extension. And what became tricky with the extension is that if you're going to use cows in a show, whether it be, you know, like a film or theater, they're best used when they are pregnant because you don't have to milk them. So I looked after the cows because they were billeted, like all actors at the Blythe Festival that come in from out of town. Myself and the lighting technician, Michael Cruz, we were in charge of walking the cows back and forth from the theater to their billet between shows, before shows, after shows, every performance. I did get to the point where locals would kind of like follow me down the street taking pictures because they thought it was the most ridiculous thing ever. Because at that point I had jet black hair and combat boots, had never like left Toronto ever. So they enjoyed watching me walk down the main street, walking cows home. The cows who, you know, were going to give birth, one of their due dates fell in the extension weeks of the production. And so we had conversations with the farmers themselves and the local vet about what that could potentially mean for, it was Bessie that was going to give birth during the run. And well, it'll just happen. The show must go on. And so basically Michael and I just kind of kept aware of her over the run of the show. We noticed one night, Michael kind of said, oh, okay, Bessie's like, there's something leaking, but it's definitely not pee. I kind of went, okay. And then you could tell she was on stage and she was kind of moving around and shuffling and making some like noises. So from backstage, I made sure all the actors were good. And then I went into the offices and called the vet. It was a double show day. We were in the matinee performance. Once the show ended, We got all the audience out of the theater as quickly as possible. We locked all the doors and we brought the vet on stage to check out Bessie. And sure enough, she was going to birth that calf. When the vet had kind of put on the giant glove that kind of goes up to your elbow and kind of like checks how things are going, he recognized that her uterus was inverted. So he was going to need some help in order to kind of get the calf out. So we enlisted the technical director and the head carpenter, who we had termed the shit boys for the run of the show, because they would come at the end of the show with a big shovel and they'd like scoop up all the poo and pee and then bring it back to the barn. So they were good sized lads. The vet went in, he tied these ropes to the calf's legs inside Bessie, and then they each held a rope. So the vet, kind of with his hands inside, was basically turning the calf, trying to kind of extricate the calf while the guys kind of pulled out the legs. So basically, and you know, the cat, like they birthed that calf on stage. And yeah, it was quite messy. Everybody was sliding around and everything, because it was quite wet. And the calf was like, you know, amazing. Got up on its feet, I would say within maybe like 20 minutes. We dealt with the calf, TV cameras came and took, you know, all sorts of, you know, the Wingham News came and put it on the 6 o'clock news. And then there was the big decision, like, what are we going to do for the evening performance? And Ted came on stage and was completely and utterly horrified, because at this point she had given birth to the calf, but now is the afterbirth. He was like, I can't be upstaged by afterbirth. While we were trying to kind of wait out the afterbirth, because I think we were also in debate as to whether or not maybe it would come out and then she would do the evening show, who knows? All the production folks, we bought burgers and we were watching the afterbirth kind of come out. So she would like contract this whole giant, like 7-year-old gelatinous goopy thing would like come out and we'd be like, go Bessie, go Bessie, go Bessie, go, in time with the contractions, and would come out and then it would go and get sucked back in again. So we did this for the entire dinner break, eating burgers, but it was clear by about like 6:30 that it wasn't coming out anytime soon. So I got the privilege of walking Bessie back to her billet. And it was the fastest walk I've ever done with a cow, because we put the calf in the kind of shit truck to kind of drive it back. So as soon as Bessie saw that her calf was in that truck, she was like, where the hell is that calf going? And so she just like went down that ramp and was like out the theater. I was like running down the street with her, chasing the truck. So she got the night off and we did do a little disclaimer. I think actually I went out before the show and kind of let the audience know why we weren't having Bessie for the evening's performance. And she got a standing ovation, I believe. We did a show that night without Bessie. And then the next day she came back and she did her next performance. When I came back to Blythe the next season, I wanted to go and visit Bessie to see how she was doing, and they'd killed her.
Hello, my name is Arwen McDonald. I am a Toronto-based stage manager and baker.
Now, you're a stage manager, but this is about from before the stage managing times. When you were a dresser?
Yes. My very first job, proper job in the theater backstage was as a dresser. And I did that for quite some time. I became an apprentice when I was about 23, I started apprenticing. But prior to that, I was a dresser and it gave me a good feel for being backstage and, you know, the delights that exist back there. You know, it's super fun.
So that was, what year was this, the story you're about to tell me?
Now listen. I think it was 92.
Right. Far enough in the past that who's going to contradict you?
Who really knows? Yeah, exactly. Well, it was my first show on my own, just me maintaining the wardrobe and, you know, making sure it's all pressed and clean and also taking care of quick changes. So that was the first time I was ever on my own. It was a cast of seemed like thousands. It was like 20 guys and 5 or 6 women. It was the Dream in Hyde Park. We were doing, it was called the Wars of the Roses, but I don't think it's properly the Wars of the Roses, but it was, oh my gosh, Edward IV.
Surely one of the Henrys.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It was not properly Wars of the Roses, but that's what we called it. Under the banner of, yeah. And the two directors were Peter Hinton and I think Bob Baker.
And Hyde Park Outdoor Theater, back in those days, it was just a hillside. Now it's a beautiful amphitheater with tiered seating. But that sweet stage, that little stage down in the bowl,
yeah,
that was there already.
That was there. Right? And I do believe that was the first year that stage was used.
Oh,
so it was built for those plays. And it was just a hill. I mean, during rainstorms, sometimes we would slide down that hill on garbage bags and just have, you know, get all muddy because our show was canceled. And
hillside was sliding into the stage.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that particular show, you know, as I've told you, is probably the worst luck show or series of shows I have ever worked on in my career.
Were you rehearsing outdoors?
We rehearsed outdoors only. So I joined during tech, and I think it was the whole month of June was tech. And the whole month of June, I think it was like the first couple of weeks were really cold and it actually snowed.
So
that's super fun. We had heaters backstage in the outdoor dressing rooms. And most of the cast had to start one of the shows in their skivvies, like just sort of panties and bras and pants. And the designer had to provide a whole another bank of wardrobe. They had to wear long johns and stuff because it was so cold. It was always like, okay, where are we going to be tonight? And of course, midsummer, it was like, just give me the panties. I can't. It's too hot. So we rehearsed all of June and we opened in July and never, ever, ever did 3 shows in a row because it rained so much that summer.
Oh,
it rained so much. I mean, we all got really good at determining what the weather would be and whether the show was going to be canceled, and we just go to the bar.
Right.
That new stage, one night, Nigel Sean Williams jumped onto the platform between levels on stage, and it had rotted because of all the rain, and he fell clean through. Didn't break anything, bruised his collarbone, but it was like, what the fuck? The show went on, of course, you know, he was fine.
Right, sure.
One of the other actors on his way to the outhouse, the Johnny on the spot, cut his toe between his big toe and his next toe so severely, like it was bleeding profusely. And again, we just had to kind of go on with it. And it was crazy.
Was there a nail or was there
a nail? Yeah. I think it was, but it was like, what? That was kind of the beginning of what is happening? Why? we can't get any momentum going with these shows and all these things are happening. During Fight Call one time, Stu Hughes's knee went out. I think his knee was already bad or he'd already had some kind of issue with his knee, but it's a snap I will never forget. Ever. I can hear it now.
Oh, so gross.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I think the worst was the barfing flu. That was probably the worst of it, you know.
tell me about the barfing flu.
Well, the barfing flu, yeah. So we don't know where it came from, but it just ravaged the cast. And, you know, actors would come off stage after their scene and barf over the snow fence and then go back on for their next scene. And one poor young actor, I think this was his first or second show, he barfed on stage because he didn't think that he could leave. So he just sort of quietly vomited. And luckily it was supposed to be some kind of an exorcism scene, I think, like that's how it had been staged. So I, you know, I remember saying to him, like, that's okay. It sort of fits in, you know, it's you barfed. That's okay. And he was just like, oh, God, I can't believe I did that. And poor Kenneth Charlotte. Remember Kenneth?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Where is he? Anyway, he was blessed with the job of having to clean it up. And
oh, shit.
Yeah. And there was one night, I got it as well. And I remember calling Nancy Dryden, the stage manager, and just saying, like, I can't make it in. I don't know what to do because, you know, it was just me. And she said, oh, don't worry. Half the cast is out with it. So we're not doing a show tonight. We just couldn't catch a break.
Oh, God.
It was crazy. Yeah. And
I
remember
the cold and the rain and the
injuries. And by the time we got to the Bluma, we were all so like, as these things go, you know, we were so in love with each other, but we were all so fucking sick of each other, you know, like, I'm trapped now, like, you know, doing all three shows and just, it's already been from June until I think at that point we got to like November. It's a long time to be doing these intense, you know, shows. And I remember one point during tech there as well, I heard sort of a, you know, kerfuffle on stage, and one of the actors was holding a prop knife at another actor, just saying like, don't fuck with me, man. And I don't know what happened, but Dryden was like, okay, let's take a 5-minute coffee break here, folks.
Oh shit. Spot the actors, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'll threaten you with this prop.
Yeah.
That's a great story. Did you ever win the lottery?
I did not.
Oh.
But I always knew that I was going to get a tattoo. I did. I got the tattoo anyway.
Yeah. Oh, good. You spent your own money on your frivolous
thing. That's right. Fuck this shit.
Does the tattoo commemorate this experience?
No. Hells no. No. No, I have my memories for that. No.
Yeah, that's right.
I get a little like white rose on my shoulder or something. No.
Yeah,
no.
Exactly. Oh, God. Despite this horrible experience, Arwen has gone on to have a long and distinguished career as a stage manager. She's also a professional baker, which I believe is how she remains sane. Sometimes the job of a stage manager is to observe what's happening in rehearsal and then carefully, without anybody noticing, fix what's happening in rehearsal. Alan Teichman has been a stage manager at the Shaw Festival for decades.
I did a production of One Touch of Venus many years ago at the Royal George Theatre, and one of the things that needed to happen in that show took place in a barber shop, like an old-fashioned barber shop with one of those large chrome and maroon leather, all singing, all dancing barber chairs that tilts and drops back and does everything, right? And the particular scene involving Julie Martel, who is this girlfriend of the barber, she had to come in, sit in the chair. Someone would come in and she was not to be discovered. So the barber, Kyle Blair, would throw a barber's drape over her. And I forget who was coming in, maybe his mom or something like that. She would yank the cloth away and Julie would be gone. And the way that Julie would be gone is she would have collapsed herself into the seat of the barber chair. And then she'd pull the seat back over her head. So there was an empty seat when the time came. She had to stay in there for like 15 minutes or something until we could wheel her off stage.
And do that silently, I assume.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At the beginning, everybody was kind of laughing because it took some effort to do it silently, if you know what I mean. And so there'd be like shaking cloth and quiet swearing and stuff like that while it happened the first few times. But we arranged for the assistance of a professional magician by the name of David Benn in terms of how we were going to do the mechanics of it. And his assistant, also named Julie, who came in because she's a very petite woman. She was also very good at folding herself up into furniture. And so she could give good advice. We all gathered out at the prop shop one day to look at this barber chair and to sort of introduce Julie, the cast member, to it. And Julie, the assistant, demonstrated how it could be done. And everybody's thinking, yeah, okay. Looks good when you do it. And Julie was now faced with the task of actually doing this for real herself. And her concern was not so much that she couldn't get in there. It's that either she would just be like completely claustrophobically panicked inside there, or that she would not be able to get out, both of which I guess are kind of related. And so in order to do this, I scheduled a separate rehearsal in another room with just Julie, the chair, and myself, so that she could just come to terms with the beast that was going to swallow her whole, right? And do it without a dozen other people standing around going, oh, why don't you? How about if you...
Oh my God, that's the worst.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I didn't even put it on the daily rehearsal schedule. I did it quietly because I also didn't want the prop shop showing up going, oh, why don't we come and, you know, we can say, no, this is not going to work that way. We spent about an hour in there with just, you know, you get in this much, you get in that much, you get in for 30 seconds, but you don't close the lid on yourself, you know, and then closing the lid and sitting in there for 2 minutes, or you're sitting there staring at me and talking to me, you know, and then like, working up the nerve to close the lid. And then, you know, her working up the nerve to like do the full 15 minutes sit in there.
Right.
And how could
it you was 15 minutes, was it?
I think it was. It was a good chunk of time, and we just sort of worked our way up to it until everybody was, well, everybody, I was fine with it, until she was comfortable with it.
That's the show. Thanks for listening. Next week, it's our last episode of the season. I'm going to have a conversation with the actor Evan Buehling. We'll see you then. Just One More is produced by Kevin Sexton with music from Deb Sinha. I'm Michael Healy. Thanks for listening.